Take the CPA. Yes, we're ready. Welcome to the June 19th, 2023 Finance and Administration Committee meeting, and now it will begin. And apologize for the delay. We have our experts here tonight working on it. Got us up and running. The meeting is being conducted in person at Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may ultimately participate remotely by using the toll-free call-in number or Zoom webinar link provided in the committee packet, which is posted on the SUV Water website. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public. It is not required. The members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. For members of the public who are present and would like to comment, please complete and submit a public comment card to the administrator to help expedite this process. To participate in public comment from a computer, tablet, or smartphone, please click the raise hand feature in Zoom or dial *9. When I announce the agenda item on which you wish to speak, when it's your turn to speak, please dial *6 to unmute. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments first from members attending in person and then those attending remotely. I will then ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. These will be taken in order. Hands are raised. The committee then comes to a consensus to move this item to the board in its consideration. Any PowerPoint presentations shown at tonight's meeting will be posted on the SUV Water website. Tonight we have Director Armitage, Vice President Kusai, and myself, Director Peterson, and Director Colley is absent. We'll continue on with the first item of the agenda, which is a Pledge of Allegiance. Stand. Place your right hand under your heart and follow after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands,
one nation,
under God,
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Now we move on to item number two, public comments.
Yes, we do have public comments tonight. Sam Holtzberg, you may approach the podium if you like, and you'll have 3 minutes to speak.
I will make it very clear. I don't think you have a full number of people here to take a vote, do you?
We have,
you only had three?
We have a quorum.
These?
Three.
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 All right. I would really file whatever I can to stop you if you do approve this tonight. I don't think you're set up here. You can't really, even if you had people here, but anytime you're going to do something as detrimental to the taxpayers, it shouldn't be done under these primitive methods we have going here. And it really should be challenged because I've read through some of this. I had other problems going on, not problems, but things I had to attend to. And when I started reading through this, I just got very irate that something like this would even be proposed. And the amount of money you want to commit, that ratepayers to. And I don't think some of you are really enough versed in what this really stands for and what it will do to the ratepayers. I haven't had time to read all of it, but I get angry every time I start reading another chapter or another phrase of what's going on. And especially when one of the big expenses is PFAS. Well, one of the things you should be looking at is where did it come from? Instead of coming up with huge amount for the public to pay. I know where it came from. And you can don't have to take very long for you to find out where it came from and make them responsible for it. But when I see things like this, I get so exasperated about this, whatever you want to call yourself, a group. Do you tonight really have enough here to vote on this? I certainly hope not. And I hope we don't have to take more serious actions to what's been going on here. And
thank you. Your public comment is complete.
Thank you, Ms. Notemeyer. We are a committee to make recommendations to the board as a whole. So that these items tonight will be considered at a future board meeting. The other public comment?
No public comments at this time.
Item number three. Recommend approval of adopting resolution setting Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency tax rate for fiscal year 2023-24 and requesting levy of tax by Los Angeles County and Ventura County. Patterson.
So the agency set ad valorem property tax rate, not to be confused with the portion of the 1% property tax that we received, pays for the state water project contract, which includes constructing, maintaining, and operating the infrastructure associated with the project, as well as the delivery of the agency's water supply allocation. On an annual basis, the agency needs to submit by resolution the ad valorem property tax rate to the Los Angeles and Ventura counties the first week of August. The agency needs to appropriately set the tax rate so that the projected revenue covers expenditures and provides an adequate any balance for future year costs. Although the fund balance is projected to be about 2.5 times the annual expenditures for fiscal year 23-24, you can see in attachment one, the expenses begin outpacing revenues in a couple of years. The construction costs for the Delta conveyance projects begin ramping up in fiscal year 26-27. In order to keep a minimum fund balance of at least 1 year of fixed and variable costs that's paid to DWR, an increase in the ad valorem tax rate will need to be considered somewhere around fiscal year 29 and 30, as shown in the attachments. Assuming that there are no changes to our current assumptions. Staff recognizes that the state water project costs are increasing each year and will continue to increase annually based on discussions that staff have had with DWR. There are some potential changes to the way DWR will be preparing the statement of charges beginning with calendar year 2024, which is why this fund and the proposed for the tax rate are monitored very closely. At this time, staff is recommending that the Finance Administration Committee recommends to the Board of Directors to keep the tax rate at 0.0706 per $100 valuation for LA County and Ventura County for this fiscal year. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Erica, are any public requests?
No public comments at this time.
What that? I guess I don't have any comments on it, and the recommendation is to go ahead to or that the board of directors adopt this future board meeting. So with that, I would recommend that. Now, is that a situation that we put on consent, or do we have to do that?
We have it on consent for the last couple of years, unless the tax rate changes, but it's we're recommending it to be the same.
Thank you. So with that, we move on to item number 4, is recommend approval of a resolution authorizing the approval of the preliminary official statement issuance of the 2023A revenue bonds. Patterson?
So just the introduction, so just a note in case I forget, this is a comprehensive effort from all departments in the agency. Big thanks to our senior financial industry, Arna, for circling the horses and routing all the questions for bond counsel, which is very helpful. We do have Laura Nichols, vice president from Field Manola, as well as I think it's either John or Doug from Stradling that will also be going through the presentation. It's pretty short and hopefully concise and easy to understand. We got the message pretty clear from last meeting. So go ahead, Laura, with the presentation.
Thank you very much, Rochelle, and good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here this afternoon, evening, to present to you the preliminary official statement the finance team has prepared in conjunction with agency staff on management, who has reviewed profusely the paragraphs and details provided in your agenda packet. We are recommending this packet of the POS be moved for approval to the board meeting at the next scheduled board on July 18th. Today's presentation provides an update of certain financial agenda items that have passed since we last spoke, as well as our future financing schedule to date, and then providing and also an update of what the POS is and the importance of that document before you today. Next slide, please, Erica. As an overview, the tasks that have been completed with the finance team is, if you recall, back in February, the finance team met with both the finance committee and the board to review and discuss the agency's long-range financial forecast based off assumptions that were prepared in conjunction with the fiscal year 2023 budget. In conjunction with that forecast was a discussion on potential future rate impacts to rate payers pursuant to those assumptions, again, indicated in the budget. The next month, in March of 2023, the EPA announced new PFAS regulations that after further review from agency staff and engineering departments, it was determined that future PFAS treatment facilities would be needed for some of the agency wells out of the total of 45 wells that the agency has currently through this PFAS regulation that will be enacted over the next 3-year period. There has been indicated new PFAS treatment to be necessary to be built by the agency over a 2 to 5 year period. In the slides to come, we provide a brief overview of what those current cost assumptions are as provided by the engineering department, and those have been incorporated in the fiscal year 2024 budget reviewed by the agency. In April of 2023, we brought before the finance committee and the board the legal documentation in connection with the 2023 bonds. And as a refresher, the 2023 bonds are going to be issued to fund needed capital improvement projects for the agency in the amount of a $75 million project finance budget. Today, we are bringing before you today the also required preliminary official statement. We hope that that POS then gets put in front of the July 18th board for official approval. The approval by the board will then indicate future movement of the financial plan with certain assumptions indicated in the resolutions that allows the authorization for staff to issue the bonds following the next meeting's approval. Today in the subsequent slides, we also want to go over some new updated information, again, pursuant to the new PFAS regulations that were announced by EPA in March of this year. Next slide, please. some of the PFAS regulations on the capital side, after determining what those maximum contaminant levels were by the EPA, indicated that there might be an approximate need for almost $160 million in new additional PFAS treatment improvement facilities, again, to treat additional wells of the agency. In order to operate those new additional treatment plants and to operate the current PFAS treatment plant that was in completed construction in 2022, those O&M costs have been updated to reflect an approximate amount of up to $6.1 million over the next five-year period. Those updated capital costs and the updated O&M costs are currently being incorporated into the POS document that you have before you in your agenda packet. After reviewing those additional capital costs and O&M costs, it was determined that the additional rate increases that were provided to Finance Committee and the Board earlier this year are not sufficient to meet those additional costs. Current estimates have those new costs and rate increases at approximately 12%, assuming the rates are enacted by fiscal year 2026. However, we have provided a new opportunity that we think could be beneficial to ratepayers to smooth out those potential rate increases, thereby incorporating up to 10% rate increases of the first few fiscal years if those rates were to be enacted by July 1st, 2024, and then reduced over down to 4% over that 10-year period that was presented to the Finance Committee earlier this year. We expect to bring back before the committee and the board additional financial forecast plans and rate plans in the near future. Next slide, please.
Yeah.
Just provide an overview again of the 2023 bond issuance. Typical financing structure to issue capital financing is a 30-year term. What we have presented here today is a new opportunity that we think will benefit the agency in connection with lowering the interest expense on these 2023 bonds. Again, the 23 bonds is what will be issued pursuant to the preliminary official statement that's in draft form in your packet. And again, that's to finance approximately $75 million of capital projects. But as I mentioned earlier, there is additional capital needs of the agency. Approximately $160 million of some of those capital needs is pertaining to PFAS treatment. And as we indicated earlier this year, agency was accepted to apply to the WIFIA loan program to fund additional capital improvement programs through this 10-year financial forecast period. What this slide goes to show is opportunities for the agency that you can execute in connection with the 2023 bonds that will also have impacts, positive impacts, on future debt issued in connection with the WIFIA loan, which is a separate financial structure that we are not looking to approve today or the next board meeting. The WIFIA loan is a transaction that's currently being run through the application stage, and we hope to bring it back to the agency later this year and then hopefully close in 2024 timeframe. To put this into perspective, I want to draw the agency's committee to the beige highlighted line items. As I noted, a bond issuance, a typical term is around 30 years. Each maturity has a different interest rate. The longer you go out, typically the higher the interest rate is that the agency offers to the market. And based off market conditions, as of June 5th, 2023, a 30-year bond issuance had an all-in cost, a borrowing cost, approximately 4.3%. That relates to almost $150 million in gross debt service over that 30-year term. If, however, we were to shorten that term to a 15-year maturity, that shortens the amount of debt issued over a shorter period of time, thereby reducing the cost of that borrowing down to a 3.3%, which reduces interest expense by almost $50 million. If you were to further reduce that bond issuance for the 2023 capital financing to a 13-year term, that again reduces the cost by additional 0.3% or a few extra million dollars. By restructuring the bond issuance contemplated here today for the 2023 series, we can also structure and layer in a new financing structure for the WIFIA loan, which has only one fixed taxable interest rate that is executed at closing, which, as I mentioned, might not be until 2024. So these interest rates are still subject to change. But were the agency to have executed a loan on June 5th, that fixed interest rate would have been 3.9%. And with a 30-year term, we expected that cost to be approximately $650 million to finance up to $260 million of capital financing projects. But as you see, as we go down the line by shortening the bond issuance to additional shorter terms, we're able to optimize and increase the savings on interest expense, or in other words, reduce interest costs to agency ratepayers. We've estimated, based off market conditions as of June 5th, that total interest cost savings on the bonds and the WIFI loan are estimated to be approximately $63.5 million. So we will be recommending going forward a shorter term of the bond issuance, again, to reduce the interest expense and optimize the full finance plan of the agency going forward. I think the next slide here is to go over the actual POS document that's before here on the agency's packet. But I did want to stop here and ask if there's any questions at this time from the chair or the committee.
Let's wait on the questions, okay.
Perfect. Hearing none, I'll pass it off to Mr. John Guz of Stradling Yalka to go over the preliminary official statement documents on the next slide.
Thank you, Laura. Good evening, committee members. Thank you for taking the time this evening. As Laura noted, included in the package that you have is the draft of the preliminary official statement. The preliminary official statement is a document that is provided by the underwriters to investors in connection with the sale of the bonds. It describes the features of the 2023 bonds, as well as a description of the legal documents that were previously approved by the agency and the authority. It sets forth the pledge of water revenues, and it provides material information about the agency's water operations, and also identifies key risk factors that investors should take into consideration when making a determination to purchase the bonds. The information about the agency includes all the material information that is necessary for investors, and we have included that information in Appendix A. The offering document, because it is provided to investors in connection with the purchase of securities, is subject to federal securities law. And, generally speaking, that requires that the information in the document be accurate, that it be free of any misstatement of material fact. And it also does not have any omission of material fact that would be necessary to have such, missing statement included to prevent the information in the document to be misleading to investors. The compliance with federal securities law is ultimately the responsibility of the agency. The draft resolutions that were also provided, one for the authority and one for the agency, approves the preparation for the agency of the agency section, the distribution of the agency section to the underwriters. And this would be the Appendix A that details information about the agency, as well as the audit financial statements will be included in the continuing disclosure certificate. Then also authorizes updates to be made as we get closer to the posting of the preliminary official statement to reflect any changes in facts and necessary updates. And then after pricing, to update the agency section of information related to the pricing, which would set forth the terms of the bonds pursuant to the sale and any other changes to the legal documents required or necessary by virtue of the sale. Similarly, the authority document provides for the preparation and distribution of the authority section, which are the exceptions that are not the ones pertaining specifically to the agency, allows for updates to those sections, and then also provides for updates to reflect pricing, and then the distribution of that updated document being the official statement. So that is what will be approved when those resolutions are put forth in front of the authority board and the agency board, respectively. With that, I'll turn it back over to Laura.
Thanks so much, John. I think that concludes our presentation for this evening. I'll turn it to Mr. Chair to see if there's any questions from the committee.
Public comment, Erica?
We do have public comment. Cam Holzer, you may approach the podium today.
Are you on item 3 or 4?
This is item 4.
This is item 4. All right. It has to do with PFAS, correct?
Right, it's next.
You're on item 4.
Yes, the bonds item.
and they're going to issue a revenue bond. And it's basically for PFAS. Can you tell me where PFAS came from? Do you even know? Do you care? This is talking multi-millions of dollars, apparently, for the treatment of PFAS. I know what it is. I also know where it came from here. And you're just getting it because you took over all the water that comes off of all the property that has it. And you're going to, I haven't had a chance today. I've had other issues that I wanted to look into. But I have yet to hear anything that would justify any huge amount being taken out and the ratepayers pay it back just for someone who will make a fortune off of his property because he's never had to pay for PFAS. Now, if you know all that and you still want to go ahead, I just really am getting more disgusted and wondering how things are being handled in this water agency. I haven't had time to go, but as soon as I saw this, revenue bonds, that means the ratepayers here, we're the ones that pay it back, don't we? Is that correct? Yes. And that if you submit us to this, I think there should be an investigation as to what is really going on with this agency. Because you're putting a huge burden, excuse me, I'm sorry, on the ratepayers. And this shouldn't be on them at all. It should be from the source of the PFAS. And I don't see, I haven't had a chance to go through this, but I haven't seen if you've done any studies. I do have some more hers in here. And I'm going, I don't know if they really know what they're doing or why are they doing it. We shouldn't have to. I think that's my your comment is complete.
Thank you, Ms. Neumeyer. Any other comments? And please, General Manager Stone, if you want to add.
Sure.
Sorry, sir.
That's all right. That was a really short rebuttal period. I'll try to speak loud because of our audio-visual situation tonight. I appreciate Ms. Neumeyer's comment. I think we would all like all responsible parties to pay for contamination and cleanup. At the same time, we need to move forward with installing the necessary treatment facilities to protect our water quality and community. And so the financing isn't in and of itself in any way absolving responsible parties. We have litigation in process with the manufacturers of at least a portion of those chemicals, the firefighting foam chemicals. There has been no sign off on liability for any other party in this valley, and they are, you know, subject to developing a case under whichever applicable law might apply at that time. That's not currently a circulated regulated chemical either, which is another problem. That could happen. So in the meantime, though, I think the agency does have the responsibility to provide high quality drinking water and to meet the applicable regulatory limits that are set based on public health considerations. And so unfortunately, we are, as the public agency, tagged with the responsibility to protect the public health right now. And over time, we may make recoveries. We certainly did in the perchlorate cases. We had to take some early actions while litigation was pending. And ultimately, we're repaid for some of those actions as part of the settlement. So I would just say that the two are not equivalent. The financing of the capital improvements is not equivalent to absolving any other party that may be held responsible in the future for that contamination. The only other thing I'll point out is, and that is good observation, PFAS is a large portion of that Lithia capital improvement program, but there are other capital improvements as well in that program. So just didn't want the impression to be that it's solely for PFAS. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments online?
No public comments at this time.
All right, thank you. Board of Directors, Vice President Bootside, please.
All right. Thank you for your comment, General Manager Stone. I will just say one spin on that. California OES sets the California drinking water quality standards, not us. EPA is now in the process of adopting an even lower standard that is supposed to include health protection and cost. The agency has commented on the impact to our agency and likely many agencies, because regulations come at a cost, and we need to remember that. If we don't do this treatment, we will either be serving water above EPA limits, or we will turn our wells off and run out of water. So neither of those is very palatable to our customers. So we're faced with these choices, and we'll try to minimize the impact to the customers. By the way, the WIFIA loan is a very good deal, and we're lucky to it's not 100% guaranteed, but we're getting close. So that is going to be a huge deal with very favorable repayment terms, and we're very lucky to be in that program and moving towards the finish line on that. So I have only one question. Do we need to decide the rate question and the bond term tonight to move this item forward, or is this like a template of which those other things will be considered later?
Laura, did you want to answer that one?
Yes, the information at the POS document includes certain assumptions in the financial forecast over a five-year period. So you can read through the assumptions that are made to prepare the five-year forecast in connection with the final rate decision. Today, we're not asking for an approval of any future rate actions. We understand that is up to the board during a new rate hearing process. And so we're providing just different options that could be implemented by the agency going forward.
Laura, I think Director Bootside's question had to do with the 13-year, the 15-year, or the 30-year option.
That was one of it.
Yes, the term itself is going to be a structure opportunity from the agency staff. By approving this bond issuance, you are approving that those terms conditions be satisfied through the bond issuance itself. There's no requirement for the agency finance committee today or the board to approve those terms, but we are suggesting that our recommendation is to issue a shorter term to a 13-year maturity of the bond issuance.
Okay, so when will the board be involved in the decision, whether it's a 30-year, 15-year, or 13-year?
That's a pricing discussion that we can have with board approval if the committee would like so at the next board meeting on July 18th. It's not necessary, though. By issuing the terms of the resolution, you're authorizing staff to make those pricing decisions.
Okay, and then secondarily, the rates, you said there's a five-year calculation of expenses, but one option would be doing a change the rates as early as next year, which would certainly be within the 5 years. And the board hasn't heard that issue either. So how can we do a five-year projection without knowing how the board is going to decide on rates?
Well, we do have the financing plan already approved, but it was approved only 1 year sooner. The rate study would be 1 year before, but not 2 years. So one of the assumptions was if we go 1 year sooner than that, we can smooth out that next year of rate increases from a 10 or 12% to a 10%. But if the board chooses not to do that, then we would go back to our approved financing plan that we have starting in July 2025.
But do we have to decide that before this is published? Because it affects the five-year financials.
No.
No, we don't have to. So we can approve this without knowing that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So first of all, thank you, Ms. Carpenter and Mr. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Thank you to our staff at SB Water for whoever helped coordinate it all together. It's a lot of information. I will say that as I prepared myself to read the preliminary official statement, I was prepared for a bunch of financial jumbo lingo that I was going to have a hard time understanding, but I was actually pleasantly surprised by how readable the majority of the document is. So that was good. I found a lot of good information within certain context. So I did have questions on slide 4, but I did ask ahead to Ms. Patterson. Thank you very much for answering those questions for me. And then I just want to say thank you for presenting the options for the shorter terms for consideration to either staff or board, whoever ultimately makes that decision. It's nice to see those as options. I'm assuming that the agency will try to make good use of saving on interest costs, however possible. That's it. Thank you.
I only have a comment. The preliminary official statement is a document that I've seen many times over the years. Part of it's still very familiar from being written up previous bond issues. But with that, we are just only considering that for the board to approve the official statement, this next preliminary official statement in July, but it is good to know about the interest rate discussion too at that board meeting. So with that, I think we'll move that on to the board July 18th. Director Ducey.
So I'm still not clear. You said we can either have the board decide or the staff decide whether we do 30, 15, or 13. And then, but if the staff decides, so say they say we're going to go with 13, that affects the rate smoothing that we already looked at, and we have to revisit that rather quickly. Should we elaborate on that more by the July 18th? Because if we just say, okay, go with the 13, then that forces us to look at a different rate scenario.
I know for the first 2 years, and I can't remember the next 3 years of how we had estimated the payments. I think they were pretty close for the first, they were a little bit less for the next fiscal year and the fiscal year after that. And then they start ramping up a little bit. Laura, do you recall in the year 3, 4, and 5, the payments versus what we had originally proposed?
In connection with the proposed budget, the current cost estimates for this bond issuance is slightly lower than the previously approved budget. So the total debt service costs looked at in the 24 and 25 budget are slightly higher than the current costs presented here today for the estimated 2023 bond issuance. For the structure proposed between 30-year 15-year and 13-year, those payments won't dramatically change by altering the final term of the bond issuance. Each structure does assume pushing out the principal amortization beyond the five-year period. So your interest payments would be similar for each scenario in the five-year period cast.
So it doesn't affect the near-term rate, but we still would need to decide the rates earlier and the board didn't see them. Can we have a little bit more detail on that when it comes to the board so they understand? I think that that's an important component And it may be a wash, but just if we're going to be asked to look at the rates earlier than everybody kind of had nodded to, I feel like they shouldn't have been. Okay. I mean, we're either going to do an earlier rate or anything than we thought. Or
we were going to bring that the new financing scenario structure in the next couple months anyway to just... Now that we have a new budget approved, we have new projects like PFAS and other projects that we can update our financing scenarios.
All right, so we wait on that and we just tell them, let's just say the board says, yep, 13 years sounds great for the bond issuance, and you go ahead with that. Then the rate change is either going to be steeper or we have to do it earlier, right?
Well, if we do it earlier, it smooths the rate increase out to almost what we had before.
Right.
Starting in 25, it would have been about 10%. We started in 25 with the new added cost for the new capital, it would be around 12%. If the board thought it was a good idea to move it ahead an additional year to 2024, then we could smooth it out and have that 10% in the first year rather than waiting a year and going up from 6.5 to 12.
I just think the impact on rates and rate decisions of the board is going to have to do, you know, this will go through and then we're going to have to reconsider rates, but that's dependent on this 30-year, 15-year, 13-year question. I think that should be made clear to the board that by doing this, we're going to come back and consider some other rate actions that we didn't talk about yet. Because everybody was thinking, I don't think anybody was thinking, you know, even 2024 was on the table and now it's on the table.
It really wouldn't be any difference for this particular bond issue and what it's going to do to the rates. But the new variable is the additional projects that we would be asking for additional WIFIA funds for. So that's what would be driving something different than what we're currently talking about.
Then this presentation confused me, and maybe want to reword it when it comes to the board, because I thought the bond term was driving the rate change, but if it's the projects that potentially make every decision, we should make that clear.
The bond term, just because with the repayment terms are very flexible, it allows us to have a different bond term.
Right.
So we can push out those with the repayments to the end of the bond and save the agency some funds along the way.
More clear that this affects the rate decisions, whether it's the bond, whether it's WIFIA, because it sounds like we're going to have to make some decisions that we were not expecting to make. So let's leave it at that.
All right. Moving on to item number 5.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, John.
Thank you. It's interesting we have CRISPR here tonight.
Yeah. First of all, I apologize for what's going on here. Did our best to kind of adapt and move forward. Had a failure of one of our devices that kind of the centerpiece that controls everything. So luckily we have a board meeting tomorrow. We contacted some support we have coming in the morning. So we're going to troubleshoot and get it figured out before tomorrow night. So thanks again. So with that, my slides are up there. The air is out of my balloon. So it's a reboot. So again, thank you again for the opportunity to present an update to the committee on technology. The plan is going forward is to do this on a quarterly basis. I know we lost some rhythm based on everything else that was going on. So we're back on course. And it's pretty daunting. There's a lot going on in technology, as you can imagine, from stuff like here in this room with the audio visual and then we'll get into it right now, stuff like that. So the plan going forward, though, is we'll touch upon different areas each quarter. So I'm not going to really touch on everything because there's just too much. And I'll have a little subset of projects and kind of projects that we're working on and kind of focuses on some of our disciplines that are active in some areas. So that's the game plan going forward. So the next slide, Erica. So as you may remember, tech services is made up of these various disciplines, these various work groups. So we have GIS, which is mapping and spatial analysis. We have information technology, which traditionally is computers and networks and some of the challenges we're having today. And we have cybersecurity, which pretty much touches everything. Cybersecurity, it's kind of evolved in the last 5 years to be part of pretty much everything. And then lastly, we have the last group on the PowerPoint there is operation technology. That's a new space. We created that term. Well, that term technically comes from federal government. But we've created that department or that specialty in our agency in the last 6 months or so. We have one person in that department right now. His name is that department right now. We're right now in the process of recruitment. We're after another SCADA technician one. As well as we're also in recruitment for an IT technician one as well, right in the middle of that right now. Next slide, please. So projects, like I mentioned earlier, we have tons and tons of projects. There's like everything, as you can imagine, is connected to the internet, or connected to computers, or connected to some electronic device, everything. From our postage machines to our printing machines, to our audio visual equipment. But these are a handful of projects I wanted to touch base on. Relative to the upcoming endeavors in our strategic plan, so I thought this was these are kind of important little areas that I probably should share. Give you a sense of these spaces in the future as we start working on our strategic planning. So the first item here listed it says satellite to internet configuration. Satellite internet is an alternative to traditional internet. You know, all of us have either Spectrum or some kind of cable company running a cable to your house. All our offices have physical infrastructure. They have either a Spectrum line or a AT&T line physically going to each office. And what we did in the last 6-12 months to get this done, but what we did is we're talking with the operations folks, the folks in safety, the folks that were kind of leading the charge in regards to an emergency operations center. So they located that at Pine Street. So that's where it's at right now. So if there was a catastrophic event, a seismic event, a sizable earthquake. Of course, most likely, highly likely that physical infrastructure will be down. Most likely, we'll be in line with Spectrum to get internet back going. We'll be in line with AT&T trying to get stuff going. So strategically, we located two satellite internet locations. So we have one set up now at Earl Schmidt, and we have one set up at Pine Street, which is the location of the Emergency Operations Center. And what that allows us, if there is a catastrophic event, it allows us to use the on-premise generators and use voice over internet. So our phone system would communicate using satellite up to space, coming back down to wherever else outside, hopefully this region, and be able to communicate for resources. Same thing with our email servers. We'll be able to send emails from those two locations. We can't do it from anywhere else, but those strategically located places where we could communicate via the satellite in space as opposed to the physical infrastructure on the ground. The next project I have listed here is important because we've reached that maturity level as an organization. That maturity level that we've invested 5 years in infrastructure, 5 years in consolidating all our systems, our applications. We have four of everything, four accounting systems, four customer service systems, four of everything. And we're finally getting to that point where we've consolidated. We have a couple more systems to consolidate, but we're getting to that point where the natural progression, the next big step, is towards data culture. And to accomplish that, these are kind of some of the pillars of a data building a data culture. Is one, we're piloting a data warehouse, a proof of concept. A data warehouse is kind of like what it sounds like, a big warehouse where you stick a bunch of stuff. But this is a virtual warehouse. It's a giant database that we assign aliases and we make it functional so folks like Darlene could run run analysis on data. So right now, there's various data keepers within our organization that have, they're in tune with some legacy, you know, database and some legacy system. But as we go forward, as we pilot and we test our data warehousing concept, that will open up that data and the opportunity to use that data for analysis on a lot of our business practices. So that's the concept behind that. We're kicking that off in the next couple of weeks, actually. We've been planning and thinking this all through, and I think our kickoff is actually next week. So I'm excited about that. And right along with that, it's listed data governance. It's governance, but governance comes right in line with the data warehousing concept. Governance, as it sounds, is about policy and procedure and responsibility for this data set. So that's something that we're going to be working to define as well. So I wanted to share that. So again, those are space advancing us towards a data culture as an organization. Then the last two items here, I have a data center upgrades. Right now, as we speak as well, we're in the process of upgrading the machines, the data center here physically at Rio Vista. Years ago, I mentioned that we consolidated all our infrastructure into one location. So, before we all merged together, we all had our different data centers across the valley. And, of course, that was inefficient from an energy standpoint, inefficient from a computing standpoint, inefficient to a maintenance standpoint. So we consolidated all that here physically 5 years ago. And we've come up to the point where it's time to upgrade again. And what's exciting about that, the upgrades that are happening right now, they open up a whole world of possibilities, so to speak. If you can compare, like, if you had an iPhone 8 and you have an iPhone 14, you can see the dramatic difference between running a newer piece of equipment and its capabilities and its usability as opposed to something old. And right now, it said we're upgrading our facilities here. And what that's going to allow us to do is it's going to open up a lot of possibilities that we didn't have before. It's going to, number one, increase our business function. So our applications that are locally hosted. Right now, we're still in a ratio of 60 to 40. 60% of our computing power is still physically on-premise or in an office, and 40% of it's on the cloud. That ratio over time will change. We're going to be trending towards more and more cloud solutions. But right now, it's 60-40. And what that also does for us, that computing power here physically upgrading, it allows us to do more backups. So right now, we only have enough horsepower to either do business or do backup. We can't do both at the same time. But this next generation of technology we're implementing right now as we speak will allow us to do additional backups during the day. So as you know, that it's important now in this world of cybersecurity and warring nations. And lastly, that asset management, that's a term that we're all familiar with. Any organization worth this grain of salt has an asset management program. We have a handful of different legacy paths, and our team's been working. I know myself and Jose Huerta, our GIS manager, have been working with operations, and Keith Abercrombie and Mike Albert. And we're about to kick off another step in the direction of an asset management program. We're bringing in some a needs assessment. We have a group do some needs assessments on all the different departments and understanding all our workflows. And then we'll be putting together an RFP to find the best enterprise asset management solution for our agency. And that will be happening in the next 12 months here. So I wanted to share that as well. So it's a big, big endeavor. It's a huge, huge lift. And I wanted to share that. So next slide, please. So, like I mentioned, when I just wanted to start it off, I'm going to focus on just two areas, cybersecurity and operational technology. That's it for today. So I have a couple of slides here, some information to share. So under slide here, cybersecurity, I've listed on the top there, EPA, that says sanitary survey. For those, are familiar with the water business, a sanitary survey is a triennial survey conducted by the Division of Drinking Water, carrying out their role. They have primacy. They're carrying out the Safe Drinking Water Act. So the Safe Drinking Water Act is a federal rule, and the state agency has primacy to carry that out. In California is a Division of Drinking Water. So Division of Drinking Water, every 3 years, they visit all the community water systems, and they do evaluation. They do a thorough evaluation of their operations, of their credentials, of their equipment. It's an incredible endeavor. I think they spend like 2 weeks climbing every tank and investigating every single possibility of operations in a water agency. But EPA, as of As of December, the EPA made a declaration that they're going to add cybersecurity as a component of a sanitary survey. So I believe we completed our last sanitary survey maybe a year and a half ago. So our next go around, cybersecurity is going to be a component of that sanitary survey. It's good to hear because cybersecurity has been getting a lot more bones, a lot more structure in the last 5 years. You know, when we started, there was no real document to turn to how to do this or how to do that. There wasn't a roadmap. But things are starting to come together, especially with what's going on throughout the world, the global climate. That's all kind of coming into structure now. And part of that was, again, a lot of people aren't happy about it, but it's a necessary thing that needs to happen, of including cybersecurity as part of that process. So listed also, I have a penetration test. Penetration test, these are kind of best practices here. Penetration test is an evaluation, a systems evaluation. We get an outside party to kind of run an evaluation of our systems to see where the weak points are, where we need to upgrade or patch or fix. And so we do that on an annual basis. We just completed that a couple months ago, and we're about 85% through the mitigations necessary to patch all those vulnerabilities. So it's a process. That's something that comes up annually on a cybersecurity insurance form. Is you conduct annual penetration tests, you remediate those types of things. So that's something we just completed. We're in the process of completing. Then system monitoring and response group, that's something relatively new to us. We've brought online some services that help us monitor everything that's going on 24/7. And in addition to that, we now have resources that are available. If there was some catastrophic attack, let's say, and there was a major cyber attack that impacted us as an organization, we have resources at the ready to make a phone call and get active and jump into the trenches and help us solve the problem. So that's something that's pretty incredible to have in place, and it's important in this current environment. Then best practices I mentioned. CISA is it's a federal agency, cybersecurity infrastructure security again agency, the federal government agency under the Homeland Security Department, and they have a list of best practices, and that's kind of our marching orders from a cybersecurity standpoint. Is trying to meet all those best practices. So that's something that's continual in progress. Things change, and we keep adapting to that change. Part of those best practices listed there is another best practice is endpoint monitoring. We have additional systems that are surveying all of our equipment and helping us let us know that which patches we need to put in place on a daily basis. Next slide, please. So I'm going to zoom down to the bottom of this slide. There's some more best practices. We have some cloud security, routine patching, best practices, vulnerability scanning, like I mentioned already. But I wanted to point out, we spend a significant amount of time and we take this very seriously, cybersecurity. We've done this in the last 5 years because it was a weakness of our organization, frankly, and we put energy and focus in that. So with that said, we conduct bi-weekly internal meetings. We have a group of five folks that we meet on a bi-weekly basis. So every other week we sit down and we look at the trends. We look at what's going on globally. We look at what CISA's telling us, what the FBI is mentioning, or what our colleagues are saying. And we take action, or we adjust also educational opportunities. Okay, we need to get more education on this topic. We need to maybe do this topic in our next upcoming cybersecurity training, et cetera. So it's something that's constantly living and constantly evolving. And that's what I learned over the past 5 years is that's the only way you can do this. There's no set it and forget it in cybersecurity because things are constantly evolving and changing. And then additionally, in addition to the bi-weekly meetings, we also have two consultants we meet with on a monthly basis. So once a month, we have two folks we meet with in addition to our cybersecurity team internal. And we discuss, again, global issues, things to look out for the next few months and adapt and change. So next slide, please. So here I wanted to share, this is one of our campaigns. You might remember this, but I'm not sure if I sent it to the board or not. But we have a...
You did.
I did? Okay. So we have a cybersecurity campaign specifically focused on phishing. Phishing is a humongous uptick globally right now. And so we put some energy to come up with this interesting campaign. So folks opened our emails and read them. So with that, we have a monthly campaign workshop. We have a new tool in our Outlook, which is a little button. If you have a phishing, you get the little button and automatically quarantines it and sends it to a notification to us so we can see, are there any trends within our organization so we can block the rest of them that haven't been open. And so before we started this campaign about 4 months ago. So we're in month four. And the winner, we put everyone's name in a hat, so to speak, and we pull out a winner monthly. So it's not how many you report, but it's just reporting, and we put you in a raffle or whatever. And the winner gets a plush fish and a $5 Starbucks card. But they love that plush fish. I think we have 12 different fish for the entire year. But that led to a humongous uptick in our phishing reporting. We went from less than 25 phishing reported per month up to 100 per month. So that's a great success. Next slide, please. So finishing off kind of our talk on operational technology. So operational technology, aka SCADA, for those who familiar with that term. It's a newer space, again, kind of borrow that name from operational technology inside of government. And we're, again, working, kind of following our models and what we learned on the business side and applying those concepts where possible to our operational technology side or SCADA side. With that, we're in the process of documenting and mapping out our entire network. And you can't imagine how detailed that is, because I think in a couple slides later, you'll see how many devices are in that. We're upgrading. We're in the process of scoping out the upgrade of our SCADA system. So our SCADA system is a little bit older than our business system. So our SCADA system is about 7 or 8 years old. We're going to be upgrading that in the next few months to, with more robust technology that allow us more backups, more processing power, et cetera. And we're working to build redundancies and follow best practices. Next slide, please. So it's a continuation of what we're doing in operational technology. Again, systems inventory. We're also working back when I was talking about data culture. There's also a ton of data that we use from the SCADA side of things. So there's a handful of folks in this organization that run reports on a monthly basis provided to the state or to division of drinking, whoever they're reporting them to. But some of our systems are kind of clunky and slow. So part of our upgrades is we're trying to figure out ways to automate reporting so things are more simpler. So there's a report automatically dumped in your email or dumped it somewhere else where you can just grab that and send it off to whoever you need to send it off to. So again, those are operational efficiencies rather than wasting time fumbling around trying to put together a report every month. It's going to be automated. That's what we're doing towards. And the same thing, again, like I was mentioning, security and permissions. And we're also evaluating a backup strategies. We have a traditional backup strategy in our SCADA systems, our operational technology, but we're looking again to leverage some of the technologies that exist in kind of the business side that will allow us some more contingency, I guess that's the right word. Next slide, please. So this is my last slide here. It's just a count. I wanted you all to see kind of the asset count of what we have. We have thousands of almost 2,000 devices within the operational technology and the IT technology. We have 743 managed devices within the IT. That's laptops and virtual machines and servers. It says here 165 iPads, 177 iPhones, 126 workstations. All that stuff on a routine basis, every Thursday, we're patching all this stuff. We're trying to keep up on top of all that. That's one of the critical best practices from stuff. Then alongside that, there's a graphic there that shows you the operational technology side. We have 656 devices within operational technology. And what's incredible is those 656, there's only one person in that department. Of course, he's working with all his other colleagues to get this done, but there's a tremendous workload that this organization and this team maintain on a daily basis. So the next slide. That concludes my presentation. If I'd be happy to go into any detail or answer any questions.
Thank you, Chris. Do we have any comments or questions from the board? I mean, from the public?
We do not have public comment at this time.
What was that from the board? Director Robert Tony.
Thank you. So first of all, thank you for the quick backup setup tonight. You guys did great. You know, technology is like, we all know technology eventually will get a hiccup in it, and you guys are just on it and set it up and you got us moving. So thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Really enjoyed hearing that information. I, especially cybersecurity, that's always like in the back of my head, something that I worry about, because I just feel like that's just the world we live in today. So I really appreciate getting the update on there. And it's reassuring to me to hear it. Part of me, though, in the back of my head is like, should we be sharing all this information publicly? Like, I don't know. But I mean, honestly, I'm asking that question. Is it okay to have these conversations publicly? Or, like, is it appropriate to maybe have some of it in closed session? Because I still want to hear the information. I think it's important for us to hear it. But if somebody really paying attention and...
Yeah, I think some of it could be closed session.
Yeah.
We haven't told you the other stuff.
Okay.
I purposely leave all important details out.
Okay.
So this is, again, this is all we're talking about is best practices,
okay,
what's federally broadcast across the entire United States of America.
Okay.
And that's what we're meeting. I'm not specifying any specific tools or any, you know, particular applications we're using, just generally that we're working with this. That
included. Yeah, that said, you know, I'm maybe going to combine two thoughts. Since it sounds like we'll have to include some cybersecurity assessment in the next sanitary survey, maybe we could have a companion closed door briefing for anything that's not public in that survey, just to give the board members an idea of the, you know, the full scope of activity that your department, you know, is undergoing on a regular basis to try to stay ahead of the arms race, so to speak.
That's a great idea. I've been looking forward to that opportunity. So it's great.
That kind of...
Yeah, well, I
punch that ticket for you.
Yeah, I mean,
I'd be curious. I mean, I hear about it. We talked about it a little bit. But focus, you know, it's always going to be a slice of time. So whatever Chris can brief you on, closed session this month, you know, in 4 months there'll be something new or different. But I do think getting an occasional slice in time of what's happening is helpful for the board, because obviously we come back and we ask you for money, so it's like you have a little bit of idea of like the public stuff and then why, yeah,
money and staffing,
why have to buy all this stuff and pay all these people and,
yeah, you know.
Well, I think just from reading the news, you can tell how important it is. So again, I don't want, in, I hope my comment, I don't mean to dissuade you in any way from giving us this information, because it truly helps me sleep better at night knowing that this is happening and this is the work that you're doing.
No, I was having the same thought. Like, boy, if I saw this, I'd compose a phishing email with that fish in it tomorrow.
Thank you. And then just lastly, so speaking of the fishing reels, I'm just curious, and if you don't know off the top of your head, that's totally okay, but do you know what the percentage is of the people who click on the little fish hook and send it off to you for analysis, is what percentage are actually fishing reels?
I don't know.
Okay, that's okay.
I can tell you this, though, because it's called fishing prone percentage. So our percentage was down to 1.3. So that means of all the hundreds and hundreds, 1.3% are actually being clicked, you know, going the wrong way by the user. So we're down though, but last time I shared this information, we're at 1.7, so we're down to 1.3. So again, education is working.
Yeah. I think we're seeing the same campaign that staff see when they're doing the education. I think they're really great. They're like short, to the point, and I think they're effective. So kudos. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Director, for asking about the phishing reporting, because I will say you've just made me extremely paranoid about not clicking on anything, which I don't. And I think the few times I usually just, but because I don't run Outlook, And that was my one comment on that training. If anybody else is logging in remote and not, I don't know if you make everybody on use Outlook. I don't, so I can't click the thing. But if I'm suspicious and I want to open it, I will ask first if it's legit, rather than take a chance.
Yeah.
Most of them I just delete. And on CISA, at least with the Homeland Security Program that I deal with, you have to get a clearance to talk about certain things. And I'm wondering if that's the line for a closed session versus open session. And maybe we can look at that. I don't know if what you're dealing with has some clearance requirements on internal items, but even then, like, the board may not be able to hear some stuff. If there's a clearance requirement that they certain of your staff have to do. But I know that that applies to chemical security programs, so maybe it's infrastructure related programs that you're doing. Just a thought. I love your slides. I think your slides are a model for PowerPoints. I kind of comment on PowerPoints a lot. And I like that you had clear bullets, but then you could speak to every point in great detail rather than putting a wall of text on the screen. So those, I like your slides. Question, just really high level for the board. So I know all these systems have to be upgraded. I know a little bit about technology, like you don't want to be the early adopter, right? And then have it be incompatible. So how do you make that decision to when it needs to be done? I mean, I heard you say 5 years, it's 7 years old. You know, everything can run faster, it can run better. Do we evaluate for compatibility also before pulling the trigger on an upgrade that, you know, maybe it's the new snazzy thing, but it doesn't work with everything? Or how do we, where's that balance between we should fix everything every year and buy new stuff to let's wait, this is good for now, and we think in 2 years, you know, how do you make that decision?
Well, I think right off the bat, we follow what's called industry best practices. And if industry best practices are every 5 years, you replace a computer system as well as a data center.
Okay.
So we follow that. But the systems we replace them with are not necessarily the most cutting edge.
Okay.
We're a couple steps behind, or the bleeding edge, I guess that word.
Okay.
No, we're not there. I think for a bleeding edge would be, you would probably implement the AI or other technologies in place or... We're not there, but again, that's we follow industry standards.
Okay.
The number that we came out of nowhere is based on what everyone does.
So yeah, and it's right. I mean, I realize it's a cost. It's a cost that the board has to look at, and it's a balancing act. So okay, but if it's a best practice guideline that you're using, that's understandable. And then lastly, just another side comment on the automated reporting. How I think that's fabulous. I think that is the way to go. And speaking of AI, you know, there's always the question of having people be able to, you know, look at that and evaluate if the report has good information and or setting flags up so that if you get like a pH of zero reading spitting out in a report, that it's a red flag, not that we get the report, turn it in with pH zero, which probably would never happen. How are we handling that?
Well, I think part of that process, that report is kind of a summary of what's happened, you know, day to day with thousands and thousands of data points. And outside of our tech services department, the folks that operate the SCADA systems, that operate the endpoints, they're constantly monitoring and overseeing all of that functionality. So if there is an anomaly, I believe it's investigated and remedied.
Yeah.
But ultimately, reporting is just, it's just a suck up of everything that was collected for 30 days.
Right, but we could help them out by flagging.
It so does.
It does flag. Okay.
They get what's called skid. They got alerts. The skid alerts. When
something's out of range,
they get an alert.
Okay. That's good. Because, otherwise you get a report that is, if nobody's looking at it and there was no alerts, you can get some bad stuff.
Yeah, like a black box.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good to know. All right, thank you.
Well, and just to address your question about CISA. So CISA, yes, I have special clearance. I get special reports that I'm not able to share with anyone. but there are each report is labeled with a certain color. I forget my color sequence. So there's 6 or 7 colors.
Right.
And the certain colors I share, and certain colors I cannot.
Right.
So there is a system in place. Okay.
I'm going to keep it short, but it just, it's nice to have a new term for SCADA.
Yeah.
Fancy term. OT. Well, anyway, Chris, thank you for the presentation. And as I have said throughout my career, that I see progress every day. More computers every day. Work. All right, thank you. Our next item is item number 6, and it's Mr. Ramirez and Fleet and Warehouse update.
Good evening, committee members, staff, and members of the public. My name is Mr. Ramirez, and tonight we have an informational item for you on some regulations on emissions. This is a more of a high-level overview of the regulation, what it is, what it means for the agency, and what are some next steps that the agency will be taking. Next slide, please. So just a quick overview of the regulation. It applies to all state and government agencies. It's going to affect all vehicles over 8,500 pounds. So if you think of F-250s and above, and now some of the electric F-150s will fall under that as well. For the purposes of the regulation, emergency operations have to be a deferred emergency event. So routine operations to prevent public health do not constitute emergency operations. So when we're responding to emergencies locally here for the purposes of the regulation, those are not considered emergencies unless they're deployed. Also, emergency support vehicles are not considered emergency vehicles. So emergency vehicles would only be police and fire. So our vehicles would be considered support vehicles, not actual emergency vehicles. Vehicle purchases means placing an order, not actually receiving a vehicle or having it in your possession. And the state really split this into two regulations. The first one is a manufacturing mandate where they're requiring manufacturers to build zero emissions vehicles increasingly over a certain timeline. And the second one was creating a purchasing mandate to create a market for those vehicles. So the EPA has already granted waiver to CARB to enforce the rules on the manufacturing side. And then the purchasing mandate was approved earlier in May as well. There's gonna be challenges, but other states are also looking at and have already adopted at least the manufacturing and purchasing. Next slide, please. There are some quote-unquote exemptions within the regulations. Each one has a lot of details and nuances, but I think for the purposes of today, we just briefly go over what they are. So there's a backup vehicle exemption. There's also non-repairable vehicles. If the vehicle's in an accident or if there's a fire, and the vehicle burns, there's something for that. Daily use exemption, there's also an infrastructure delay exemption, and there's also going to be a purchase exemption list that CARB is going to create, and they're going to publish starting in January. There's also going to be a mutual aid provision, but that will probably go into effect in later years, since there is a requirement that 25% of the fleet has to be zero emissions in order to take advantage of that provision. Next slide, please. So next steps for the regulation. AQUA and the League of California Cities are monitoring the legislative bills that are being proposed in the legislature, but they're not spearheading any bills themselves. And right now they're just working on providing some communication and feedback to CARB. We know that there is a bill that is in the legislature and it's been sent to the Senate for review. And again, it's more to kind of create some leverage, whether it will pass or not, we'll continue to monitor that. But we do know that CARF has stated that they believe they've given all the necessary exemptions to public agencies that are needed. Aqua has commented that that's not the case, that the exemptions are not feasible, and we agree as well. And also the chair of the board said that they did not want to review the regulation prior to full implementation, which would be in 2028. Next slide. So as far as the agency, our compliance options, we need to start complying. That will go into effect in January of 2024. This was a point of a lot of discussion, right, that there wasn't enough time for agencies or fleets or organizations to really plan for this regulation. But the start date is still the same, January of 2024. When this is all said and done, it will affect approximately 100 vehicles in our fleet. And there's going to be two options to comply. One is a purchasing requirement that as you purchase new vehicles, they have to be zero emissions. 2024, 50% of new purchases, and then by 2027, 100% of the purchases will be zero emissions. Most fleets are going to pick this option because it's a little bit more feasible. You can comply in your own timeline, whereas the milestone will require to replace the fleet in an accelerated pace. There's other options that the agency can look into. The most important one would be to replace vehicles with gasoline vehicles before the regulation goes into effect, right? So at least new vehicles that are ordered would not have to comply unless they're ordered after January. So if we could replace new vehicles before January, then that means we wouldn't have to comply with new regulations. And that option could give the agency really a spine time, right, for the technology to improve, and then also for the installation of infrastructure, which is going to be a long process, and there's a lot of challenges with any project. Another big thing is that it would provide a lot of savings over the next 5 to 10 years because a gasoline vehicle is substantially less expensive than a gas other than electric or hydrogen. So that is something that the agency will be looking at and considering. Next slide, please. When it comes to infrastructure, there's going to be a need to bring consultants, and there's it could be brought on at any point, whether it's assessing a compliance path, submitting exemption applications to CARF, assessments for our fleet, as well as charging, or whether it's designing of the infrastructure, building the infrastructure, and there's also other new areas that are developing charge services, charging as a service, charging operation, maintenance, or you know the agency to just own and operate and maintain the infrastructure as well. When it comes to infrastructure, we're looking, I think, at two phases. The first one is really short term. It's what can we do within our existing infrastructure? And that's going to require us to complete a site assessment for each yard and facility. It's essentially looking at what's already there, both on our side as well as the Edison side, so we can figure out what kind of chargers we can support. Next slide, please. Phase two is the long-term vision with knowing and planning for everything to be zero emissions at some point. So that's going to take substantially more time, 3 to 7 years. And that's going to require really doing a suitability assessment of the fleet using data from telematics, also charging, it's figuring out what type of chargers and how many we need. That's both with the site assessments and data from telematics, designing of the chargers at each of the locations and figuring out type of chargers. Also submitting applications for grants and other programs, including Edison, to also bring dedicated services just for electric charging. We're also going to have to design the infrastructure to be able to support emergency preparedness, and that includes battery storage as well as load management, so we don't get hit with time of use charges. And then that will require going into bid, as well as going into construction phase. That's the long-term. Next slide, please. Other infrastructure options that we are looking at, so it's mobile charging or temporary charging. So you can see on the top left, there is an electric backhoe that's being followed by our electric lightning that's towing a big battery, which is just a heat generator. So that was part of the test. And those mobile chargers can provide in the short term infrastructure to support vehicles. And then in the long term, it could just be emergency power and current in case of power outages. So those big batteries are very expensive. The one that you see behind the lightning is around 80K. The one that you see right below on the right side, that's about $500,000. There are some incentives, but it's only $130,000. So, it's still very expensive. There's also semi-permanent solutions like you see on the top right, which is a container, which it's not technically permanent, right? But it's semi-permanent. And there's also new services, like I mentioned, charging as a service. So if you can see, there's an electric van at the bottom right that's charging our other two vehicles. And again, that's something that we can use in the short term while we build the infrastructure, as well as in case of emergency if our chargers are down for maintenance or anything like that. Next slide, please. When we look at transitioning the vehicles, we have to be strategic. So something to keep in mind is that EVs or just zero emissions vehicles, they have high acquisition costs but low operating costs. So right now it's very expensive, right? Because there's no infrastructure. Once the infrastructure is in place and technology gets better, costs will come down and we'll see some savings and over the life of the vehicle than upfront. So they have to be, it's kind of like Goldilocks, right? It's, it can't be used too much and it can't be used too little, otherwise it doesn't make sense. So you just have to find the right use. So the first 5 years is going to be, we're going to be looking at low-hanging fruit, which is going to be passenger vehicles, sedans, SUVs, office full vehicles, our IT vehicles, some of the supervisor vehicles, and then also some of the pickups at two of our yards. Those are smaller vehicles, and there's vehicles that are going to be available. Lightning and the Silverado will be available to meet those needs. The next phase will be 4 to 7 years, which is the semi-difficult. These are going to be vehicles that have utility bodies but travel less than 50 miles per day and also do not tow. So any vehicle that tows, as soon as you tow, it cuts your range in half or more. So that will be left later on. Some of our other vehicles, we have water quality vehicles that travel and take samples. It's usually those planned routes, so we can plan for that. And then the last one will be 7 to 10 years, and those are going to be extremely difficult vehicles. Those are going to be our crew trucks, that are our frontline vehicles that tow and have heavy payloads, and also our commercial vehicles, because again, those vehicles build and don't assess right. That's kind of the phase approach when it comes to vehicles that's like this. One of the things that we'll be using is the data from telematics devices to really provide validation on which vehicles should transition first. I think we have, feedback from operators, and just from the supervisors knowing, what their routes are, but the data will really provide that information so that the operators don't really have to collect that information anyway. So. That will help with completing suitability assessments for the vehicles and help identify which ones can be transitioned first. And it will also help with the design of the infrastructure. So knowing how long a vehicle sits at a yard, for example, will help us figure out which type of chargers, whether they can charge overnight or whether they need to charge during their break or during their lunch. And then also look at driving patterns and that sort of thing. One big thing is also battery health. So that will help us figure out when's the best time to get the vehicle if we see that the battery is the rating cool time. So that's that. That's it. So, and then if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Any questions, any comments, public comment?
We're not showing any public comment at this time.
That, any questions, Director? Vice President Kutzeit.
That was a great presentation. Really reassuring how you've thought through the most strategic way to comply with the rules. Earlier was Chris's presentation about you don't want to adopt too early, just in case. So I think it's a great strategy that you outlined. I like even the phasing of the consultant assessments. I think that's really well thought out and a good way to do it. One question, and I guess one comment. The whole thing is supposed to be zero emission, but if there's a power outage and we have, well, my favorite is natural gas generators, but or diesel generators. If we have generators, can we use them to recharge, or is that a no-no? Does it have to be a power bank?
No, we'll be able to use emergency power from generators.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's good, at least. And then, yeah, just my comment. I said this at the board. I heard a presentation on this, and, just like earlier, all new regulation is a cost that then gets shared with our customers. And zero emission, if we plug it in, the source has to be zero emission. We're just running off of power plants all over the place. That's not a huge savings, and I understand California has some work to do to get to clean energy as well. So this is a lot of work, but at least we're doing our end. It looks like very strategically and very efficiently, so thank you.
Yeah, and to your point about the how fast or the technology is changing, right? So, and then the last month, both Ford and GM have both said that they're going to adopt Tesla's charging infrastructure. So that's going to change probably the standard going forward. And, those were some of the reasons why we opted to lease our first set of vehicles, one, so that we can step the first generation of the vehicles, and then also for potential changes like that, that it's going to have to change. So, and I'm sure we'll have to change.
Sorry to interrupt, but you just remind me of another question. So purchase versus lease. If we're leasing, do we still have the same percentage requirements? Okay. Darn.
Unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I agree. It was really thorough. I we've kind of generally been talking about how this new CARB regulation would affect public utilities, including water agencies. And I think this really gave us the nitty-gritty details of how it's going to affect water agency owners. So thank you for walking us through that. I really appreciate that. The last slide you talked about was telemetric data, is that what we're calling it? And I know when we had a discussion at the board kind of before that got implemented and some of the concerns that people had around that. And so just as I don't want you to talk about this today, but maybe in the future, I'd be interested in knowing what other positive and negative things have we found coming from collecting telemetric data, kind of lessons learned from that. But again, in the future, not today. I'm just curious, it just sparked my curiosity about that. So, but great presentation. Thank you so much.
Actually, asked one of my questions was about the diesel generators, how they are affected by this rule. But really, it's all individually permitted still, aren't they? By car, those generators?
Sounds good. They're stationary. Yeah.
So, with that, I appreciate your presentation. It does bring up more discussion for budgeting vehicles in the future.
That's in the next couple months after the consultant gets a hold of all of our fleet and our telematics data. We would probably be coming for the end of the year for 20, 30, 50 vehicles that are gas that can get us through that midterm, long-term period for us to get our infrastructure in place, for Edison to get the ability to get our infrastructure in place. And that's something that the consultant will work with Jesus on to make sure that we we can at least operate. Because they're not requiring you to purchase all electric vehicles now, but they have gas vehicles that will get us through, I think it's like 18 years before you have to replace it. We would do it before then, but just to make sure that we're kind of ahead of the game.
Thank you.
Oh, and the other thing is there was a lot of questions from some of the other members of the board that were interested in this topic. Would you be interested in having Jesus present to the board?
That would be appropriate, yeah. Yes.
I thought it was a really reassuring presentation.
Did a fine job.
Thank you.
Okay, next item is item 7, and recommend receiving and filing in the April 2023 financial report.
Yes, so this is the reporting period through April. So on our statement of revenues and expenses through April, our revenues are approximately 15% under budget and about 11% in the date. And also through April, our expenses are about 29% below budget and about 15% under budget year to date. And through April, our net operating revenues over expenses is about $1.6 million, with an increase in net position of about $5.5 million for the month of April. And then the year to date net operating revenue is about $2.5 million. With an increase of net position of about $47 million, which is primarily due to the slow PAYGO spend. That is consistent with our carryover that we expected during the budget process. So we already knew we were going to be carrying over a large amount to fiscal year 23-24 capital plan. In April, the only expense item that was over budget was in the management department, and that's because we received one bill for our election expenses. Two years ago we got it in May, so we budgeted for it in May and it came in April. So there'll be some fluctuations in that management department. I don't have anything else on the revenues and expenses. And then this is just our short report. It's not the quarterly report. If you have any other questions, we can get to
them. The comments from the public?
We're not showing any public comment at this time.
Thank you. Any questions from the board? No? Fine. Thank you, Michelle. So the next one is item 8 is committee planning committee calendar.
As Matt mentioned, I think the last board meeting or previous meeting, we're looking at meeting some of the sections of our purchasing policy. We hope to bring that in July. Next, surveying our benchmark agencies and some other agencies just to see if we're in line. Our original purchasing policy was adopted in 2018 and it was revised a couple times, but just looking at some of the limits to see if they should be updated or if we could look at changing some of those limits that are in the purchase policy. So that'll be coming hopefully in July. There'll also be a new contract for janitorial services. And then we have on the calendar in the fall would be recommending of approval of an affordability study. And I mentioned this, I think, last month. But based on our approved financing plan that we currently have, we are showing the need for increased revenues. We felt it would be prudent to perform this water affordability analysis. This will be the first for the agency and the first for any of the legacy agencies that I know of. And it is the affordability analysis is an assessment of water affordability based on household annual income. And HBI, which is Household Burden Indicator. By review of the customer water consumption and billing data, an analysis of customer bill impacts. water affordability indicators help the agency better understand how the cost of water affects customers while also increasing the revenue needed to cover the cost of providing that service. Water affordability indicators, such as the HBI, can be used to estimate the number of customers who are unable to pay their bills and indicate where those customers are concentrated, and so that we can use that data to utilize and develop and improve our affordability programs as well as focus outreach. We will also be making sure that we come to the committee. After we select a consultant to help us out, help us out with this analysis, just to bring it to the committee for methodology and discussion and input, we don't want the dates to cake.
Yes.
Want to make sure you have an opportunity to provide input along the way, since this is our first study. And I think that's all I have on the calendar.
Thank you. Any comments from the public?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Questions from the board? Vice President Goodsay.
The affordability study, just thinking of the saying you don't want to ask a question you might not like the answer to. How do these things usually turn out? What happens? It's not something that we want to hear as we're going into rate increases, for instance.
We're not exactly sure, but Darlene has already performed some analysis, although we don't have the census data or anything like that. But looking at our increases of 10%, 12%, we're within the range where water affordability is, but of course it doesn't dive deeper into, you know, our disadvantaged communities.
Right. So what you're saying is like a preliminary screening is that a 10-12% shouldn't be a hardship for most people, but there may be some areas that have trouble. Yes. And what do other areas do given when you come back to us? I would like to know, you know, what do other areas do given that we know that there's not a state ratepayer assistance program? We have a very small one. You know, and again, we're going to be doing rate adjustments. That seems like if we get the information, we should be prepared to do something with it. And I want to make sure we're prepared to do something with it if we're going to get that information. So that would be something to discuss. Can you bring us the more detail?
My only comment is thank you for bringing it to us earlier, so it's not a page cake.
Yes.
Appreciate that.
Well, the comment I have is that I have never been involved with the affordability analysis in the PUC process, so it'll be interesting to see all this.
Yeah, I heard it come up a couple times during the last ALPA conference. I'm like, might be something we would be interested in. So I've only started doing the research and looking at consultants who could do the work, but thought it would be prudent to have that type of study before we go into proposing our next rate change.
So if it comes out the way we want, what if it's not? Then what do we do? Oh, well.
Okay, thank you. Request for future agenda items. Are we ready? Any comments from the public?
No public comment at this time.
Item 10 is a general report on finance and administrative activities.
Just a couple, and one of them has to do with the ratepayer assistance program. So as of today, we've received a total of 72 applications. Of those, five are not qualified because they're not in the care program. Other remaining 67, 46 met the priority registration requirements, which means they're in our group line, which is seniors, veterans, or disabled. And 21 are not priority and have been waitlisted. So we are currently notifying all customers who have met the priority registration that they'll be enrolled as of July 1st. And unless we see a huge spike in the priority registrations, in the next week, we'll begin notifying the waitlisted to get their enrollment so the funds, of course, don't go to waste. We originally thinking maybe August or September, didn't think we were going to have any influx of applications. But if it if we are seeing a small number, because I believe it's 833, that's how many we can afford in the program. So as long as we don't have a big influx, we will go ahead and take those waitlisted as long as they are eligible. Customer care also reached out to the local Veterans Affairs, the gentleman that was here while we were doing the program, and also to the Senior Center, and the communication is ongoing. We have bill messaging, bill inserts. It was in the June edition of the Water Currents, which is the newsletter, and the info is available on our website and posted to the login page of the online customer portal. So we are currently researching ways to access or share the CARES data. So Matt had recommended that. So we are looking to see if we could tap into do some data sharing medicine. And that will keep you updated on the periodic basis of the program. One other thing. That as a companion piece to the budget and the MACR, which is our annual comprehensive financial report, the finance department is drafting the agency's first, I think it's PAFR, it's a popular annual financial report. And the PAFR is unaudited. It is published in a less technical style for simple reading to raise public awareness about the agency's financial status and performance. The report would be eligible for an award from GFOA and will include topics such as who we are, organizational and board structure, demographics, community involvement, financial performance, and CIP projects. And again, this report will require collaboration from many departments and agencies. So it's just another another piece, another communication piece that we have. And that's all I have for the general section.
Any comments from the public?
No public comment at this time.
The directors? Thank you, Michelle. That was quick and fast. The last item is 11, so we're adjourned.
Thank you.